Time to take another walk down memory lane in the good company of Cian Manning in our Loves Me County. Cian, good to see you yet again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back again. I know a lot of people from the top of the town are delighted to hear Ballybricken and Mount Sion mentioned frequently. And I would also like to say I don't get paid for each mention of both Mount Sion or Ballybricken.
And can I confirm that is indeed the case? So just to be sure on that. Now, Waterford Poetess and Hayden's Muse.
Yeah, so we're actually kind of going to the Georgian period. We're kind of getting a bit of a Bridgerton feeling to the episode today.
Very popular at the minute.
Very popular indeed. I leave people make up their own mind about what sort of hanky-panky is going on in this story.
That's one way of describing it, but tell us more.
Particularly at breakfast hour.
Indeed.
Conscious of everyone eating their porridge and stuff.
Indeed.
So we're looking at a woman called Anne Hunter. She was actually born Anne Home. We believe she was born in Waterford on the 11th of March 1742. So there is a little bit of vagueness about her origin story. Her father was a Berwickshire-born military surgeon. Bit of a mouthful there, called Robert Home. So we know that he would have been based in Ireland from around 1737 to 1744.
Okay.
So it sort of adds to the credence that Anne was a Waterford woman. Her mother had the name Mary Hutchinson.
Still a popular Waterford name.
A very popular Waterford name indeed. The family eventually settled then in Hull. I think she has six more sisters born in the city in England then. What is kind of interesting is that Anne's future husband, John Hunter, actually would have been a really good acquaintance of her father. So John was also a surgeon. He was also in the army. And Robert Home and John Hunter go to Portugal. They're stationed there for a period and return to London in 1763. And to add to the mood, music that comes on, sort of a love story element, the following year, Anne actually falls gravely ill. And she is treated by one John Hunter, who she then marries about 8 years later.
Well, does it get more romantic than that? Talk about having a lovely bedside manner and more besides.
Yes, yeah. But also, she wasn't very quick either in marrying him after being nursed back to health, too. So I think...
So do we know when he proposed or dropped the question?
We just know that they married in 1771. So she was ill in 1764. I would say this adds to her being from Waterford. This is kind of hard to get. John Hunter, in his own right, is actually a very sort of well-known figure within medical history because he opens his own school of anatomy and he amasses a collection of nearly 14,000 specimens and samples. So it would be interesting dinner conversation.
Indeed.
Having your blas and pig's toes.
Dissecting all.
A human toe appears on the table.
Wow.
Look what I bought today.
Yeah.
So Anne, in her own right, then becomes a very well-known figure as a songwriter. So we know that one of her popular songs of the year was Adieu, Ye Streams That Softly Glide. So I was going to say, if I hum it, we might get you to sing it. I'm sure that someone has heard of it.
Give us the title of it again.
Adieu, Ye Streams That Softly Glide. So she was a pretty prolific songwriter because she actually releases two songbooks in the 1760s. One is called The Lark and the other is called The Charmer. So we could maybe assume that Mr. John Hunter could have inspired that title.
Indeed.
She receives a lot of notoriety for her poem The Flower of the Forest, and we know a contemporary critic of the time noted, a little bit of snobbery I would add in this criticism, the British critic notes that Anne Hunter's poems show no depth of thought but have a natural feeling and simplicity of expression which make many of them worth reading.
Well, there's a kind of a pat on the back and a stab at the same time.
Yes, yeah. I think it's because she brings, from reading different things, popular culture into it. So she kind of moves away to sort of mythical allusions to Greek and Roman gods and kind of roots it more in ordinary language, local language that people would, the way people
more
would
accessible
spoken, way more accessible. So you could say she is the Taylor Swift of her era. After she marries John in 1771, their house becomes like a party central. So it's frequented regularly by literary figures, music figures, well-known people within the military and medical circles. And remarkably as well, it's noted for hosting members of the Blue Stockings group.
The Blue Stockings group.
Which I have to say wasn't something that was in the back of my mind when I heard it. But apparently it was an informal organisation that promoted women's and social education.
Right.
So it was very much looking at women's rights and the idea of cooperation to advance women's pursuit, I suppose, of improvement of their social status.
What a strange title then, the Blue Stockings.
Yeah, yeah. I presume it refers obviously to them wearing that particular garment.
Indeed.
But But so Anne Hunter obviously is very much not just a creative mind, but obviously socially conscious as well, which seems to be a kind of recurring theme with some of the female figures we've looked at over the few weeks. Unfortunately, there's a lot of tragedy in Anne's married life as well. So we know that she gives birth to 4 kids, 2 boys, 2 girls. We know that her second son, Jemmy was his nickname, dies quite young. And then to sort of compound tragedies further, you have this bright note of her second daughter. So her 4th child is born in early January. And then just a few weeks later, in early February, her second child, her oldest daughter, dies.
Oh, God.
So I just can't imagine moving from the joy of a new life
indeed
in the house to then a young life departing way too soon.
Very difficult.
But then again, it probably reflects what many people of that era
were experiencing.
Yeah, and certainly coming from a kind of more wealthier social class.
Mm-hmm. Give you some idea how the lower classes,
exactly,
if you want to call it
exactly
that, were faring.
And I suppose like all creatives manages to harness this tragedy into what is considered by many to be her most important work, her greatest poem. It was an elegy to her son, which was called To the Memory of a Lovely Infant, and it was released in 1782. And again, it just has a really poignant closing stanza. It goes, "She graves with trembling hand the mournful rhyme, where memory recalls departed time, bring back in one short hour the dream of years, and sprinkles on the grave a mother's tears."
Oh my God.
Which has a very kind of modern sensibility
it
to
does.
It when you think
it does.
Like we're talking,
and obviously from the heart.
Yeah, centuries and centuries ago.
Yeah.
So again, moving aside from the tragedy, the Hunter household is very well known, as I said, for these sort of literary and intellectual parties. So this is your Bridgerton element.
Indeed.
And we know that she tours Europe herself in the early 1790s. And this is where she meets, I've heard a couple of different pronunciations of this name, but it's the Austrian composer Joseph Haydn, or Haydn. Mm. We could nearly talk about him for as long as we're talking about Anne Hunter, but he is considered the father of the symphony. He was a mentor to Mozart, a teacher to Beethoven.
Very accomplished individual.
Yeah, like he's believed to have sort of originated the string quartet. For people of my vintage, we would probably know for the fact that when he died in 1808, that his head was departed from his body for about 140 odd years.
That is mad. I had heard about this, all right.
Yeah, so someone stole his head and they tried to study the lumps and bumps to see what
made him so great.
Yeah, it was his genius. Mm. And it was only in 1954 that body and head were reunited finally.
Just imagine.
So it's a kind of a cool story if anyone wanted to look that up. Joseph and Anne become acquainted, and they actually collaborate on some of his canzonettas, which again I had to look up, is basically a secular song. So again, we can kind of trace a movement away from, I suppose, the religious psalms and hymns, that we start to get this kind of more popular, perhaps sort of emotive songs within Europe primarily, and then towards England. And these were published in 1794, and Haydn actually dedicated them to Anne Hunter. So we know that some of the lyrics she worked on were in those canzonettas, and she also published poems, The Spirit Song and O Tuneful Voice. And that kind of gives a little hint to the relationship she had with Haydn. So we know that when he leaves England, she's inspired to write this poem. She notes in it, "O tuneful voice, I still deplore the accents which I hear no more still vibrate on my heart."
Ooh, it was a bit of romance there, perhaps, or at least admiration.
I can see why he had a string quartet. A kind of poetry being written about you like that.
Indeed. That should be an inspiration to anybody, really. And was she married at the time?
Her husband would have died, off the top of my head, in the early 1790s.
So she was a free agent.
Yeah, maybe. Haydn was, you know, that famous phrase I remember from college, when there's grass on the field, play ball.
Yeah. So. He wasn't hiding from anybody, really. Keane Manning, listen, that's where we got to leave it. Anne Hunter, Waterford poetess and Haydn's muse. Thank you so much.
Thank you.